I've been down roads from Churchill to L.A. Met kings of speed and stars along the way. They got stories that the cameras never show. Yeah, the truth behind the fame is what we know. From the saddle to the silver screen glow, fast lanes and punch lines on a late night show. You think you've seen it all, but you don't know the half till the curtain lifts and we all have a laugh. It's not just who they are, it's how they came to be. A little horsepower, a little mystery. It's Hollywood and horsepower, baby. Take a ride where the legends laugh and the engines never hide. From the track to the spotlight, stories unwind. Yeah, the truth's a little wild and one of a kind. Hollywood and horsepower, where the real ones show. Every twist and turn is a tale you didn't know. So pour a drink, sit back, enjoy the show. Where the fast and famous let it all go.
Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the show about the story behind the story. We are joined today by a very special guest and guy that's like family to me, ongoing guest, Buck Wilson. We're going to talk about a lot of things today. It's a pretty exciting week, pretty full week. I mean, we're Kentucky Derby week, Formula One Miami. We're into spring baseball. People are starting to make their summer plans. And we never miss a show without talking about old Hollywood and restaurants that we love. So, Buck, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Good. How's your week going? I appreciate you joining us again. It's always a good time. Sometimes I feel like we talk more on the air than we talk off the air.
Oh, this week is going about normal. Dinners to take care of. Houses to keep in order somehow. The weather, though, here has been really, really good. And the big, like you said, the big thing for this week is Pelican Beach Condos on Saturday. We're having a Kentucky Derby party. So all the elements of that getting together.
Well, and that kind of gears us in. And I mean, I will promise the show, and I've always said, Hollywood and Horsepower is about the story behind the story. So we're not going to give you guys tips for who to bet on. I'm not even going to pretend to tell you who I think's going to win. Don't really have a feeling, and that's not who we are. But I will say, and for people that have ever thought about it, you know, I know everybody always says Kentucky Derby is a bucket list item. You know, obviously Buck and I have both been, and, you know, it is an experience. There's no question about it. But, you know, it's also more than just the actual Derby. You know, I would encourage you, if you're ever thinking about going, take the time and spend some time both in Lexington and in Louisville and do more than just the Derby. Like, you know, go to the Derby, maybe go to one or two of the events leading up to it. And then, you know, there's everything from the Louisville Slugger Museum right there in town to 4th Street Live with great restaurants, bars, and live music to, you know, old friends over in Lexington, the Horse Park. Obviously, the Kentucky Derby Museum right there at Churchill. So, I mean, you know, Buck and I have both spent a lot of time in Kentucky. It's kind of a, you know, special place for both of us, I think. What, I mean, give me some of your highlights, Buck. I mean, you've been around there as much as I have. What are some of the high water marks? Like, if you were telling somebody who had never been, what are the must-dos?
The must-dos. I would go into Georgetown, Kentucky. Would be a great place to be centrally located to get lodging. And then you could go to Old Friends. You could go to the tours. When I say the tours, I'm talking about the Bourbon Trail tours. And the way to do that, without exception, is to get a hired car for obvious reasons. And Versailles, Kentucky is not very far away, and you can go to Buffalo Trace, Bardstown is a must do because you're going to have three
speaking
distilleries
of sales,
right
not
there.
Not to interrupt, but we talk over each other the whole show, so it's nothing new. We're speaking of Versailles, anybody who's ever in Versailles, and I think you'll agree with me, you have to go to that Ricardo's restaurant.
Absolutely.
You remember that place that's on the point that's like an old train depot? The food is absolutely amazing. I'm not even sure how to describe it. It's like kind of like Southern. It's kind of like Southern food meets like a distillery thing. But the food is absolutely amazing. The people are amazing. I mean, that's one of my favorite places.
Absolutely. And if you're in Bardstown, I can't remember the name.
Talbot Tavern.
Is that the place that Jesse James shot the place up?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So if you're in Bardstown, Talbot Tavern is one place that is an absolute must go to. So Talbot Tavern was a true tavern with a hotel upstairs. And there is actually a room that they have preserved that Jesse James got in a shootout in, and there's bullet holes in the wall, and there's all kinds of pictures and things. So evidently he had kind of laid low there, and they caught up with him there and had somewhat of a shootout upstairs, and obviously he got away. In that same town, there is another place called the Rick House, and it's not Rick like R-I-C-K. It's R-I-K. It's the Rick like Rick House for bourbon barrels. So there's the Rick House restaurant that was actually an old Rick House. So for those who don't know, Rick houses are where they store the bourbon barrels while they age them. So bourbon is created and put in, burnt barrels. Buck could give you more details than I could. He's forgot more about this stuff than I know. But basically you would go through and you have to let it age anywhere. So what is it, Buck, 7 to 10 years or longer?
Actually, be bourbon, it needs to be, the requirements are the grain bill, the elements that you put into the mash that actually wind up making the bourbon needs to be a minimum of 50, needs to be 51% corn. Then you can go with whatever else. If you get one that's got more rye, it's got a little bit spicier taste like a Jim Beam. If it's wheated, it's a little bit calmer. Woodford makes a really good wheated as an example. It's all about the wort. Once it gets into a charred oak barrel, it goes in at about 151% alcohol. Then it sits in the barrel. 3 years would be about minimum for a good bourbon. Then it extends out for there all the way up to the most famous one you'll have heard of is Pappy Van Winkle. They make a 17, a 20, and a 23 year, and you get ever greater amounts of the oak. The stuff that goes in is called White Dog Liquor. It's the 151. It has no color. And to be perfectly honest, it has virtually no flavor. The oak does all the rest. And you can
coming up.
Absolutely. Once it sits in there, you've got what can either be called a bonded because it's coming off at heavy proof, or they start mixing it down with purified water until they get the flavor and the percentage just the way they like it. And then that's the stuff that goes into the bottle. It might be a mix of different years. It might be a mix of different batches. But they get that taste, and it's the one that they want to go with, that they're known for, and that's the stuff that winds up in the bottle. But a Rick House, he's talking about Rick Houses. If you ever walk in a Rick House, the smell inside the place is absolutely ethereal. It is. They lose maybe 25% of a barrel over a long age to evaporation. It's called the Angel's Share. The Angel's Share, absolutely. And that smell and that thing, it's all part of the tour I'm talking about. There are all these parts of the experience that are always absolutely worth doing. And there in Bardstown, one of the distilleries is Horse Heaven Hills. And that's a really, really good tour to go on. Also, I would say Maker's Mark is probably the most beautiful one, especially because you can dip your own. The top of it is very unique on a Maker's Mark bottle, if you don't know, because it's dipped in wax, in a very, very bright red wax. And you can dip your own bottle.
But and if you know, we did, so we've done many partnerships, you and I, with different bourbon companies. And you remember we helped old friends do their, you know, limited bourbon bottles with Maker's Mark. And that was one of the unique things that I got to see, because they actually did the wax to match the horse's colors. So for those people that weren't aware of it, back, gosh, when was this, Buck? Like 17, 18, maybe 16, 17, 18, we worked with old friends and did limited edition bourbon bottles that were horses that old friends had that had won one of the Triple Crowns, like Kentucky Derby or something. A lot of them were actually Bob Baffert's horses, you know, like War Emblem, Silver Charm. I believe they did an American Pharaoh. And then the bottle was made with the color of the silks, including the wax. It was really cool. And it was a limited run. There was only like 400 bottles each year, which I'm assuming. How many bottles are in a barrel?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great question. I can't tell you how many. If you go, let me see. Maybe I can backtrack it. Hang on a second.
I was just going to say, I'm actually shocked. We actually stumped Hemingway. I mean, for those listening, you understand now why I say that talking to Buck is like having lunch with Hemingway. He knows. He's forgot more than I know about almost any subject.
I'm going to say there's probably somewhere in the area of 200 fifths.
Okay.
But just backtracking it, the reason I say that is because they have a program at Maker's Mark where you can, I was explaining about how important the wood is. Well, you can adjust that. You can use different oak. You can use French oak. You can use light char. You can use heavy char. So there's a program at Maker's Mark where you can go in, tell them what kind of taste you're looking for. They'll put a few bottles together, pour something out and say, is this what you're talking about? And they know how to make that. So when you make your own taste, they'll build the barrel that will create that bourbon, make it, age it. And when it's ready, when the distillery master says, this was ready to go, you can buy the entire barrel. And the price on it the last time I checked was $5,300. So if you back that up from an estimated cost, that would be somewhere about $225, maybe somewhere in that range.
Oh, wow.
Speaking of Maker's Mark again, I mean, you've been there. You go through that entryway that the ceiling is all Jalili glass. It's an absolutely beautiful tasting room. It's very, it's incredibly manicured place. It's been there a long time. And to be perfectly honest, it's a really good bourbon. It is really
smart. The other one that I really enjoyed, and I think you'd agree, was going to Woodford Reserve. So it's small, you know, it's not real big and it isn't as elaborate, but it was just, you know, it's such a, you know, for those that have never been there, Woodford Reserve is right outside of Versailles, Kentucky, just outside of Frankfort and Lexington, Kentucky. And it's literally out in the middle of the horse farms. Like you're driving along and just about the time you're positive you took a wrong turn, there it is. And it's just a beautiful place. I mean, the building, I think you'd agree. It's like, it just looks like something out of a magazine.
It's beautiful.
And
absolutely.
I know that's like the Woodford wheat. I mean, Buffalo Trace, and for anybody that knows me, I'm the most mamby-pamby drinker there is. But it was actually you that got me to figure out what I like. The Buffalo Trace is probably my go-to. But, you know, for a special occasion, Woodford wheat is a favorite. And I think that's one I would encourage anybody to try that if they've never tried it. It is different than Woodford, and it's very unique. You know, we're talking with Buck Wilson, I'm your host, Mark Otto. You know, we're at Derby Week, Formula One Miami Week, and talking bourbon, travel, restaurants. And, you know, I mean, that's one that always stood out to me that you got me to try was the Woodford wheat.
Oh, it is. When you eat the bourbon, it gets a softness, but it also picks up this grain. You can tell that there's something in there. It's got a softness to it, and it's got a grain flavor that causes a sweetness. It's wonderful. Another one, back to Versailles at Buffalo Trace. If you're kind of a masochist and kind of the sort of person that likes to play golf, when you are at Buffalo Trace, get in the gift shop and buy a bottle of Blanton's. And
oh,
the reason
yeah.
I bring that up is there's an old tradition in Kentucky about Blanton's. The cork on the bottle has got a small sculpture on it of a jockey riding a racehorse. Well, there are, Mark, is it seven or eight?
I believe there are seven, and it's a series from the beginning of the race to the end.
Yep.
So it starts out with the horse
payoff
walking
on.
Up, then it goes to a full sprint, and then it goes to walking away.
Yep. And what you wind up doing is getting a picture, and they had a paper with all of them on it that you can track, that over the years of drinking Blanton's, and by the way, Blanton's, if you ever saw a John Wick movie, that's what John Wick is drinking, got really, really popular.
And that's
and
another
trivia
really
question.
Smooth, like, easy-to-drink bourbon. It isn't strong. It isn't real chemically. You know, I'm going to be the guy that dumbs it down for everybody because you understand the ins and outs and ups and downs of it. I just know what I like and what I don't like. There's some of it that isn't fit to clean paintbrushes, in my opinion. And then there's some of the stuff that's actually very smooth. Blanton's, Buffalo Trace, Woodford Wheat, those are the ones that to me are like really smooth.
Absolutely.
And I
trivia
love
point,
that.
Trivia
You're
point.
Absolutely right. So what's interesting is, so I have the full collection. I have a bourbon rib out of an actual Blanton's barrel, and it has every one of the stoppers on it. And then, so another thing that's kind of fun with that, and it's another one. So there's one that's called, is it Cask and Key? And they have like a skeleton key on the neck of every bottle, and they're numbered 1 to 5. If you collect all five, you get a personal inside tour of the distillery.
I did not know that.
That's kind of like what made me think of it was the Blatton thing. And I think that's really fun how there's like kind of like things inside of the industry that are kind of fun like that. You know, it's like, you know, you've got the Blatton product, but then, you know, the stopper collection. And I've seen multiple ways that people collect those. There's another display that looks like a big wooden horseshoe that has all the stoppers on it.
Yeah, it's, and then you wind up sitting in bars and you'll see a bottle of Blanton's up there that's starting to get low anywhere in Kentucky, you know, and ask the bartender, is that stopper spoken for? You're probably going to wind up being like the fifth or sixth or the 500th or 600th person on that's asked that question. And they've got a list somewhere of people that they took dibs on that cork because they're trying to complete a set. There's a trivia question.
I will tell you this. This is something I've learned, and since we're kind of a nationwide audience, people will probably understand this. The ones that I have picked up, I've picked up a lot of them outside of Kentucky. So, I mean, several times in our travels, just what you're describing, I'd be sitting there, and they would have a drizzle left in the bottle, and I'd say, hey, is there any chance I could have that bottle? And yeah, absolutely. They're probably going to throw it away. So it is kind of funny that, you know, if anybody is a bourbon aficionado or a follower or just enjoys horse racing and likes a unique collectible, you know, if you're ever at a restaurant or whatever and you see a Blanton's bottle, don't be afraid to ask them. You might be surprised.
Yeah, there. If you ever saw the John Wick movies, he's always drinking Blanton's. And there's a trivia question. Because in the second John Wick movie, the Blanton's bottle has a green label. And that wound up shooting around, hey, where do I get one of the bottles with the green label? It just happens that he was in Rome. The Blantons that they ship overseas comes with a green label. That's what
Oh, really? I never knew that. So that's another piece of trivia. So
we have
another connection there that made me think of that. You know, Weller? The Weller is kind of from the same family as Blanton's Buffalo Trace. That has a green label.
Yep. It's
another one.
There's a strange little things like that.
I love that stuff. And that's probably another one on our list of ones that, you know, it actually is a pretty smooth tasting one that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just not overpowering.
Yep. Another one that comes out of that same area around Bardstown is Larceny.
Oh, I've heard that.
It's called Larceny. The story about Larceny, if you ever buy a bottle of it, the label that's on the front of it has an image that looks strangely like a keyhole, like the kind that would take an old skeleton key in an old hotel door. Well, the story goes that there was a guy who worked there who was the rickhouse master, who was, you know, of not no means, but he wasn't what you'd call wealthy. And then someday somebody figured out that he was the largest landowner in the county. And he didn't have money and he didn't have a big salary, but what he did have was the keys to the rickhouse. So they pretty much figured out how he came by the money. So they named it Larceny. And that keyhole got put on the label. And it's
That's
another
hilarious.
One that is absolutely, it's wonderful. That's another one. If you're sitting at a bar and you're looking for a bourbon that's up there, Michter's with the green label, that would be one of the first ones that always jumps out. Maker's Mark would be one. Larceny would be one. Buffalo Trace would be one. All of those in Woodford, even if it's not the weeded Woodford, which is usually that doesn't turn up in a lot of bars until you get to Kentucky, since everyone is anywhere. But Woodford is another one. I can tell you, part of my duties down here in the yacht club is I'm bar commander. And I introduced a bunch of bourbons in there, and I'm in Sonora, Mexico, as I speak. And coming up with a lot of American bourbon down here is not the easiest task in the world. But I got one of the local places that has distribution out of the capital city of Hermosillo to start feeding some bourbon down here. And they can't keep Buffalo Trace in stock. And another one I had to burn down was Woodford. And Woodford goes out faster. We've got a large expat community here. And those are the two that just keep blowing out. So now they're out looking for more bourbons because it's gotten more popular.
I'll bet, and it's not to get into politics, but we might as well. So I wonder how much it's affected the availability for you. Because I have heard that Canada has all but shut off U.S. liquor because of the tariffs. So my Canadian friends are telling me that they cannot get anything up there from America because they basically, you know, unless it's currently in inventory, the stock is dwindling. They're not bringing anything new.
I have been seeing some news reports about that too, and I didn't think about it until you just said something. But again, not talking about anything too directly, but when Anheuser-Busch and Bud Light had their little difficulty a while back, all of a sudden we got absolutely flooded down here with Bud Light. Absolutely.
That makes sense. I mean, I wonder if you're benefiting by proxy from the political challenges to the north.
Man, I'm going to tell you, Bud Light has turned up in a lot of places. I'm talking in farther south. We're one of the five border states, but it's turning up down as far as Guadalajara. So you may be onto something there, and, you know, good. That's good news.
I'm sure that what they're doing is trying to offset the loss in sales to the north. And I know that, you know, to take that Bud Light, you know, derailment, for lack of a better word, they the story was the further north you went, the more damaged their sales became. You know, I think so. It would not surprise me that Canada shied away from them as well.
Makes good sense. I can tell you, if in the pockets around Mexico, Guadalajara would be one. There's one in Nayarit, Mexico City, over Playa del Carmen area, the Yucatan. If all of a sudden it got easier or it got more prolific that we had access to bourbon and we had access to U.S. Wine out of Washington, out of Napa, that would be nothing but good news for us down here. Now, don't get me wrong. Baja California, Guanajuato, they're making some absolutely wonderful wine down here. They are. Okay. But we've got a market for here as well, and it could expand out. So if that's what's causing this to happen, it's making my life easier. Yeah, I'm all for it.
You know what's interesting? Speaking of that, that's another hidden gem in Kentucky. So Kentucky has developed a group of vineyards that are growing in popularity. You know, and that's kind of, I mean, trust me, I don't even pretend to know wines. You forgot more than I know. But I, just in hearing people talk, it's interesting to me when you get these pockets like Northern Michigan and Kentucky and some of these other areas, like you're talking about in Mexico, where non-traditional regions are producing some pretty popular wines.
Oh, they're
have you
one of the
have
best
you
ice wines
that with some of the Kentucky ones?
Not Kentucky, but let me think. Some of the best ice wines.
Equus Run is one that jumps to mind, and you hear a lot of people talk about it, and it's a vineyard there. And, you know, there's just, I mean, if anybody's listening, if you're curious on trying a new one, I would tell people, you know, take a look at it, because Buck is almost a wine savant. I pick wine based on the bottle, but, you know, it's like, you know, I've heard a lot of people say a lot of positive things about Kentucky wine.
Well, hey, you never know. I'll give you, this is my example. Sonora, the state of Mexico that I live in, is basically a desert. Okay. I mean, that's basically it. Okay. So imagine somebody said, hey, we've got a wine that's made in Sonora. You're going to be immediately suspicious. However, what you don't know is that about halfway through the state, pretty much in the middle, is Sonora. It's the capital. If you go north of there, you're going to hit an area where there are vineyards that go on. I mean, literally, it's like wheat fields. It's like wheat fields in Kansas. It just goes on and on and on. And you find out in the Western United States, in the last 10 years, if you've eaten a table grape, this is where it was grown. This is where they come from. This is where the big supply of table grapes, this is where it comes from. So somebody said, well, if we can grow those grapes, what else can we do? There is a wine that is called Cuatro Sierras, is the label. It means four hills. And they are growing Rhone varietals. We're talking about like Grenache and Mourvedre and Syrah. And the wines are good. I mean, they're good wine. This is just good wine, and you wouldn't have expected it. So there's really, if no one would have thought, if you say, hey, I got wine from New York, oh, really? Wow. But some of the best ice wine made, okay, is made in the northern part of New York.
Yeah, and that's another one I was going to say. So there's a up in the Hudson Valley and then over towards Finger Lakes. I know that there's some vineyards up there that a lot of people really are very popular.
Absolutely. And the ice wine is made because the grapes have frozen. That's why it's called ice wine. There's an increase in the sweetness, and they basically make like a sauterne, a dessert wine. And
so
it's very thick. It's
usually, so they get a frost before they harvest them?
Yep. That's how it's made. Yeah. And it absolutely comes out. It's usually sold in the smaller split bottles that are 375 milliliter, and it's the kind of thing that you would get a glass of to go with like a pound cake for dessert. And they're wonderful.
Oh, wow.
They're absolutely wonderful.
So kind of like, you know, like a dessert wine.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. You know, it is interesting as we talked about this, you know, another thing that dropped this week was more tariff for, you know, comments. And again, as much as we don't give you a horse to pick on, I don't get into a lot of politics, but, you know, along these lines, what is affecting some of this stuff, I think a lot of people don't realize is, you know, the tariffs aren't paid by these other countries. So every time we say, oh, we're putting this on here and they're going to have to pay that, that really doesn't work that way. The American companies end up paying it. And it's really affected a lot of industries. I know it's affected the bourbon industry. I know it's affected a lot of imports to other products. And it's just, it's kind of interesting, the misconceptions, if you will, that go along with some of this stuff. But it is, it's also interesting that, you know, like another open. So, you know, maybe the opportunity is that, you know, it expands into other regions like Mexico and, you know, Central America that had had a hard time getting some of those products in the past.
Probably, like I said, if you want to buy the most inexpensive six pack in all of Sonora, Mexico, it'll be Bud Light. So
that's funny. Now, is it popular?
You know, to be perfectly honest, it can't be not popular. It can't be frowned upon or not being drank because the stackouts were there and then the stackouts were gone. So, but again, let's put it this way. If you go in and buy a six pack of the most popular beer would be Tecate Light.
Okay.
Tecate, if you buy a six pack, you're probably paying at the Walmart in Guaymas is about 13 and a half pesos a can, right?
Yeah.
When they put the Bud Light out, it's going for like 10. And given the exchange rate, if you don't know, 10 pesos is about 50 cents. 50 cents a can. So, you know, it was, remember when we were, you know, you remember Schaefer beer?
Oh, yeah. I would have never thought of it if you hadn't mentioned it. That's an old one.
Okay. Yeah, Schaefer. And the, you know, the one to have when you're only when you're having more than one. That was their call tag. Okay. Well, when I was in college, you could buy a six pack of Schaefer Lights for, if I remember, it was like $3.99 at the market off Balboa Island in Newport Beach, California. And that was the stuff we drank. So, you know, if they're going to put it out at 10 pesos a can, even if it doesn't have a following, it'll have one. Absolutely guaranteed.
I remember they moved another one like that. Do you remember one called Wiedemann beer?
No.
It would come in a 24-pack cardboard case. And it was these little weird, like almost barrel-shaped bottles with a bottle cap on top. And I remember, like, you know, in high school, a girl that I dated, her dad would literally have one of those sitting next to him. And the claim to fame with this beer was the case was like dipped in wax or treated or something, so you could dump ice right in the case and kind of use it like a makeshift cooler. But I remember it was the same thing. It was like something stupid, like $4.99 for a 24-pack. And I think probably tap water had a higher alcohol content. But especially if you drank it in Michigan, you know, Flint water or wherever. But it was like just kind of amazing. It always cracks me up, some of those old labels that were just almost like, you know, sewer water filtered through a sock.
Yeah. Well, in Michigan, you'd have had, this is the difference, okay, between Southern California and Michigan, where you were. You'd have had Old Style. You'd have had Schlitz. You'd have had Rolling Rock. You'd have had
the big one, actually, Stroh's. You know, Stroh's was in Detroit.
Stroh's. Absolutely. Okay. Where I was in Southern California, the beer, if you were just going on price, we had that Schaefer Lights that were out. We had the big one would have been lots of Coors Light, lots of Miller Light. And what got really popular in college was, I believe the first one was the Safeway chain of grocery stores, came out with their own beer that just had a stripe on the can, and it just said beer. That was
Isn't
it.
Isn't there one that was called Striped or something like that? Wasn't there one that had a label like that, that was their name?
This was actually Safe. The one I don't remember that one, but there was actually just a Safeway beer. We just got beer, okay? And it, what, you know, if they were that beer, if it was given away for free,
you were overcharged.
You were overcharged, absolutely. So by the time we got towards, I mean, the first thing out of school, you probably remember this. The first thing we got out of school, where you knew you were a little bit better off than you were before, is when you had gone all the way up to something like Miller High Life. Now,
the one when we were in school was if somebody got their hands on one of the, like, what we considered like the exotic. So what was the one that had like the foil top? Lowenbrau?
Lowenbrau,
like
absolutely.
Yeah, kind of like the fancy pants beer. And then there was another one, not natural, because there was nothing natural about the natural, but it was like kind of like, God, I'm drawing a complete, I was not a beer drinker, as you can tell, but it was like I could picture this bottle, and it had like a gold foil top on it, and it was like kind of a little bit more expensive. So if somebody had a couple extra, you know, shillings in their pocket, and they were looking to have a good weekend, that was usually what showed up. But as with most college and high school guys, you know, it came down to economics. So it was whatever you could get the most of with what you had.
Yeah. I just remembered a story. Okay. Do you remember in the movie Jaws, Flint sitting in his chair, he has a beer, he cracks it, he downs it, he crushes it, and then Richard Dreyfuss folds up the paper cup. Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. That beer, okay, literally was something we chased in Southern California for years. Literally for years, we chased after that beer because all we had, now think about the timeline on this, until it came to where you could have a VCR and you could stop it, pause it on that moment. You could never, all you could do was watch it go by in the theater. But once the VCR was there, you could get a look at it, but you can't really read it. You just have a general idea of what it looks like. And there was no technology in there where you could go in and show it to somebody. So you just had to walk in to stores and say, hey, did you ever see Jaws? You know that can that he's got? And you've got some guy behind the counter who couldn't care less and nobody's of any help. So eventually get into college and you forget about it, right? But this is in high school, so don't hold it against me. Nonetheless, cut to, I'm not making this up. This is the first time I was in Saratoga when we were working the horse industry. And I'm sitting at a bar by myself, and this is one of the nights before I was going to meet Big A and the people from HRR Red. Okay, I'm sitting at the bar. I've got a drink, and I've ordered food. I think I ordered a burger. A guy sits down a chair away from me. He says, hey, give me a Narragansett. And I say, okay. And the guy walks over and puts it down. I happen to be looking in that direction, and that's the beer.
And what's
that's
the name
the
of
beer.
It?
Name of the beer is Narragansett.
Okay. Right?
Okay, and you talk about when you finally get the story, because I make a complete idiot of myself. I pick the guy's beer up, okay? And I look at it and I go, oh my God, this is it. Okay, and the guy's looking at me like, you know, somewhere between, do I run for a punch? What's wrong with this guy? And I go, no, this is the beer from Jaws. And the guy takes the beer from me and he goes, well, yeah. And I go, you don't understand. And I tell him the story about chasing it. And he says, it's only sold in this area. Okay, so Seriously, I drank Narragansett
that makes
the
sense.
entire time I was there. The entire time I was there, I was drinking.
Go ahead.
No, I was drinking Narragansett the entire time I was there. So I tell the story that I just told you to Big A when we get there. And Big A's like, oh my God, really?
Swamp water? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't even think I can tell you what it tastes like, but I was so delighted to, after all those years, to have found that beer. I figured I'd just drink it the whole time I was there. Got it out of my system. But yeah, would have been at least 30 years looking for that beer, and I finally found it.
Oh, wow. Hey, we got it. Speaking of Big A, we have to take a minute and plug this. So Big A is throwing a derby party in Saratoga. So anybody that's in the Hudson Valley, anywhere in upstate New York, or if you feel like taking a weekend trip, Saratoga National Golf Course is hosting a derby party. Derby Day at Saratoga National with the Big A. They still have tickets on sale. It is a great place to spend the day. They're going to have wagering on site, food, concessions, all kinds of things. Obviously, live simulcast and everything. So, you know, for anybody who's interested, check it out. Just do a search for Saratoga National. It'll pop up. Take a minute. Check it out. If you're looking for something fun to do, that's a great place to go. We got to plug a couple other things here for a minute. MBGrayHealthcare.com. If you have employees, I guarantee you have employee benefit challenges. The person who can get you out of it and make sense out of it, and especially now with healthcare costs starting to climb and everything going up, deductibles going up, coverage going down, MBGrayHealthcare.com. She's the best in the business. She can uncode it for you, put together a package that will help you and your employees. No Fallen Heroes is a charity that we support here. It was founded by Matt Wiz Buckley. Matt is an absolute advocate for veterans and first responders. If you get a chance, take a look at their website. We don't take a penny for promoting them. We do it because we believe in what he's doing. So it's nofallenheroes.com, and he is a great guy. Look him up. If you can't do a little, do what you can. Oldfriendsequine.org is the old friends that we were just talking about. So, you know, take a minute, check those out. If you're anywhere in Central Kentucky, you definitely want to check those guys out. So back to the show. That stuff to me is always fascinating. I love those trivia, like, side pieces like that. So pivoting a little bit and staying on the East Coast, what are your thoughts on, you know, F1 Miami? Have you looked at it at all? Or do you get too excited about it, or not especially?
I haven't looked at it.
So it's funny.
I haven't really
F1,
followed it.
Formula One in the United States continues to build. And it's like it gets more popular every year. And it's interesting to me that, and I'm not knocking anybody, I'm just making an observation, F1 Miami falls on the same weekend as Kentucky Derby every year. As you know, you and I, we like both automotive racing and, you know, horses. The thing that is impressive to me is how they do it. And I think one of the things that's going to be interesting this year is the world-renowned Lewis Hamilton, who was with AMG Mercedes for so long, you know, top of the leaderboard every time he turned around, is in the Ferrari car, 44 this year. And that's a big change. So he's dressed in red come Saturday. And I think that's going to be one to watch. I'm not giving predictions. I just know that Lewis is a heck of a driver. And it's really going to be interesting to see how he does in the Ferrari car. I mean, Ferrari's got a long-standing history with F1, and they've always done very well with it. So this is kind of interesting. I mean, this is kind of like history unfolding. You've got kind of like the best driver with one of the most historic teams, and it'll be fun to see what they do.
Well,
I don't know about
I
you.
Can tell you,
Ferrari's a fun, like, it's just one of those companies that, to me, you can't help but be kind of intrigued by it. Don't you agree?
Ferrari? Oh, absolutely.
Not just the street car. I mean, the racing history, everything that they've done. And maybe it's just because I'm Italian. I don't know. I mean, it's like, but it's always been kind of one of those. I mean, everybody's seen the movie Ford versus Ferrari. And, you know, it really was interesting to read and see how Enzo went. You know, it was so important to him, F1. So it's kind of fun to see where this thing goes. Who do you generally like? I mean, who are some of the guys that you like top when you get into the, like some of the, you know, McLaren, AMG, F1, you know, I mean, you know, who are, you know, we even have Tony Stewart involved now with Haas. You know, I mean, who are some of the ones that you kind of like?
You know, when it comes to F1 racing, you know, I married a gal from Indiana.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, so when it,
but
you know, when it comes to
from Indiana, they're big Grand Prix F1 fans.
Well, they are, but I mean, the race that I wind up watching every single year, the one is the Indy 500. That's
sure.
Kind of the big tradition. But as far as from the stuff that I'm interested, that's really would be important, definitely the Ferrari team is the ones that wear the custom made for the Richard Mille watch.
Oh wow.
The RM 43, the RM 43. And that, it just, everything about Ferrari, and there's even down to the street cars. Okay. There is a mystique. There is a class about it. I mean, an RM 43 is going to be about $1.3 million. And they've got them
wow.
Down. We're in the carbon fiber models, and they're the spokesmen for it. You can't. The class that comes off of that is just. It's not perceived. I mean, it has got the European high dollar class badge that just pops on anything you put it on. And
I didn't know that.
Racing history on top of it. Oh yeah, yeah. When you get a chance. Go ahead and Google that about an RM43 Ferrari. Okay? And if you're somebody who loves watches, this is, you know, it's its own signature piece. Okay. When you get into that kind of thing, you're talking about somebody who is really committing to that badge. There are watches, I mean, you know, when a Rolex, you've got every one of the watches along the way. You've got a Seamaster, you've got sports watches from Omega.
Yeah.
You've got Patek Philippe. You've got the AMP watches, especially, you know, the ones that are the Seabound. But the RM pieces are very, very large. They've got a huge signature to it. And Ferrari went to the lengths to outfit the racers in these. Just as a brand manager, see the picture. You'll get the point. It's absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, I think the other one to watch here is worth mentioning is Cadillac. Sergio Perez in the 11 car. He's going to be another one that I think is kind of an unexpected wild card here, if you will. Not that he's not very capable, but I just. You know, I think sometimes Cadillac gets overlooked, and there's been a lot of talk about them, and I think it'll be interesting to see where they fall on the board this year. Kind of a non-traditional one. You know, I mean, it's not exactly a company you think of when you think of F1, but I know that they have put a lot into their program. You can't overlook Aston Martin ever in McLaren, obviously. And then, you know, the kings of the field is always the AMG. I mean, Mercedes, they just seem to dominate year in, year out. It's really going to be interesting to me what effect Hamilton has on the Ferrari team, because he's just so good behind the wheel. I mean, you can give the car credit, but I mean, AMG was never in the winner's circle as often before Hamilton as they were with Hamilton. Kind of interesting.
Well, somewhere between everything going on at the Kentucky Derby party, I'll see if I get to see the race.
Yeah, you know, if you guys have an extra TV, it might be worth trying to dial that one in somewhere off to the side. If you're having multiple streams running. You know, the funny thing is, so another piece this year is our good friend Bob Baffert is back, and he has two horses in this year. So it'll be interesting to see, and once again, I'm not trying to give predictions or anything else, but I will say, you know, I'm probably a little bit biased. I'm always going to be Team Baffert. I really like Bob. I think he's one of the best in the business. I think he is probably one of the nicest guys in the horse industry. And quite frankly, I think he's also one of the best horsemen.
Oh, record speaks for itself. The record speaks for itself. Absolutely.
And I will tell you, and, you know, it is. I know there's – so he has, you know, two horses in this year and, you know, Citizen Bull and Cesar Rodriguez. I'm sure that's correct. But anyhow, I'm not trying to give horses to watch, but I will say you can never overlook Bob. And I think more important than wherever he does this week, number one is the return. You know, I think that that's historic. I mean, as we know, if he wins, he breaks a record for the most Kentucky Derby wins, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that if he wins, he becomes the most winning trainer in history for Kentucky Derby. And, you know, it's funny because everybody always says, as you said, you know, record speaks for itself, which it does. But I think the part in, you know, going back to like American Pharoah, and as you know, I mean, Bob was gracious enough that he allowed Michael Blowen to tag along, and Michael was gracious enough that he let me tag along. And I was able to experience kind of firsthand his operation and his team. You know, Jimmy Barnes, Dana Barnes, you know, his George, his wife Jill, obviously is a huge part of that team. You know, Bob obviously runs the entire organization. And for people that don't understand, you know, Bob will generally have between, and I mean, these aren't exact numbers, but at any given time, he'll have, you know, well over 100 horses in training. In fact, it's probably closer to 140 horses at times. So, you know, it's not like he's just got one or two horses, you know, that he's focused on. He's focused on everything from young horses at farms to stallions that are in breeding to actually horses that are retired that he still supports. And I will tell you, this is unsolicited and unendorsed. Bob did not know that I was going to talk about him. I kind of took this on myself. I've asked Bob to come on the show, and Bob's, you know, reluctant, but he tries to stay out of the press as much as he can. But the one thing I noticed being close to his operation was just how calm he was and how calm the operation was. You know, it was kind of funny when you'd go in the barn, the horses were just relaxed. The people were relaxed. I mean, it was not like there was a bunch of tension. It was not like there was a bunch of chaos. And I'm not going to mention names, but I can tell you from walking around the backside, and you've been with me. I mean, as much as we've been around the barns, you know what I'm talking about. There's a lot of barns that all you hear is screaming and yelling and horses, you know, just about kicking the walls in. And, you know, I really believe that there's something to the tone that's set by the team. It was interesting. American Pharoah, you know, the Triple Crown winner. I remember this clear as day, and I don't remember why it stood out so much, but I believe it was the day before. I think it was Friday at Belmont, you know, kind of gearing up for it. And we were at the barn, and I just remember Bob was at the far end of the shed row past the horses. And he was just kind of standing there with his arms crossed thinking. I'm sure he's contemplating everything leading up to this moment. But what was interesting to me was every one of the horses was just standing there calmly, almost exactly like him. And it was one of those moments you just remember, you know what I mean? It's like one of those moments in time that just kind of stood out. And it's like, I'm no expert, I mean, you know, but it did make you wonder. It's like, you know, you have to think that somehow his personality and his demeanor feeds, you know, they kind of look to him like if he's relaxed, they're going to be relaxed. So it was kind of one of those telling moments. And I think the other thing it was telling for me was, like, one barn over from where we were, you could hear people yelling and screaming, horses going crazy. And it was just kind of like one extreme to the other type of thing. But I will say this, and it really was the most telling thing for me, kind of following along and being kind of just an observer, how much thought, not that every trainer isn't going to obviously put a lot of thought into training, but it was not just like, oh, you know, do this and do this. There was a lot of talk about previous horses that Bob had had and how they had trained them and what they had done. And that really stood out to me about how much, you know, it's like, yeah, there's a lot to this. It's like there's a lot of strategy. There's a lot of that. And at the same time, you know, he's getting a lot of pressure put on him, you know, to bring this horse to New York and do this with it and do that with it for publicity reasons. And he's got to balance that with what he feels is best for the horse. And that's something that really stood out to me. And that's one of the many, 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 many things of why I think that he and Jill and Jimmy are some of the best horsemen in the industry. I mean, I'm not giving anybody a prediction about the Derby. I won't do that. But I'm just saying that as a horseman and as a person, I don't think there's anybody in the industry that is more conscientious and cares about his horses and his team than Bob Baffert. I mean, I've been around him quite a lot. I know there's a lot of controversy there. I know there's people that won't agree with that. You can stop writing your letter right now because I'm not going to read it anyhow. But I'm just, personal opinion, I think he's one of the greats for multiple reasons. So that's my soapbox for the day, if you will. So we're kind of up against the hour here, Buck. They're going to be rolling me out. But before they do that, we wanted to plug King and Birdo's. If you're in New York, you have to go to King and Birdo's. If you're in Miami, go to the Palm. Tony's Steak and Seafood if you're in Kentucky. And obviously Frank and Dino's if you're in Kentucky, you can never go wrong. No Fallen Heroes, MB Gray Healthcare. And if you're anywhere near San Carlos, Mexico, you got to go to the Yacht Club and check out Buck's Derby Party on Saturday.
I'd appreciate it.
For members only.
No. Just tell him you know the Commodore.
There you go. Tell him you know the Commodore. And the beauty of it is it's the only yacht club. You don't have to have a yacht to get in.
That's a unique feature.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us, Buck. You know, we always enjoy it. And I know we didn't get to our movies. We'll have to do that again, you know, next week. But, you know, I hope you guys have a great party. I hope you guys have a great weekend. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we will see you again next week. This is Hollywood and Horsepower, the story behind the story. And wishing everybody a safe and fun weekend, whether you're going to the Derby, watching it on TV, following F1, watching that on TV. There's definitely a lot of fun things to do this weekend. So don't let the weather put you off. Get out there. Enjoy something. And as I tell everybody all the time, if you're ever looking for a fun experience that is very accessible in sport, go to a horse track, go to a horse racing, big or small. You can have fun anywhere you go. And, you know, I think Buck would agree. It's the most accessible sport of any sport. It's the most accessible of any sport. And it is actually a really fun time. I mean, you can take your kids. It's definitely not what you will picture. I think there's this image in people's heads of, you know, a guy with a racing form and a cigar and, you know, half in the bag. There is, you know, I'm not going to say you're never going to see that, but I will say this. you'll see more of that at an NFL game than you will at this. And I think that one of the things that people don't realize is just how accessible the sport is. So thank you for joining us, Buck. Thank you for joining us, everyone, on Hollywood and Horsepower. And we will see you again next week. Take care.
So stay a while. You're in the driver's seat where the road and the rhythm finally meet.
Stick around. You never know who's next. And trust me, they got a story worth hearing.